Well, when you read about him, you know, he's been on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals for 10 years. And prior to that, he served in the Bush administration. And he is noted as, and has people have commented about him as being a very straightforward kind of person, that he's a very honest person, a wonderful scholar, a wonderful writer, a very good writer, a person who can you can work with very easily. He's not anywhere. He's not a person who will hit you over the head with his point of view about things. In that sense, he's not very much like Justice Scalia, because Justice Scalia sometimes was really quite pointed and sometimes obnoxious to his colleagues on the court. Judge Gorsuch is not like that at all. His colleagues on the court, people and lawyers who know him, both in the profession and at the University of Colorado, speak very highly of him as a person. And as a person who can relate to others, and the word brilliant is sometimes overused in the law, but he's considered a brilliant scholar and writer and jurist. So he comes with very good credentials with respect to his ability to serve on the court, on the Supreme Court, relate to the other justices. After all, there's only nine of them there, so they can't be at each other's throats. And so he comes off with very high grades in that regard.
Are there any opinions that he's written that you're aware of that are likely to prove controversial as his confirmation hearing comes up?
Well, the ones that he hasn't really addressed cases in which the real where the rubber has been hitting the road in the Supreme Court. That is, he hasn't had abortion cases. He hasn't had cases involving affirmative action. He has a case in which he had a case rather. Which the Supreme Court addressed in afterwards, he had a case in which the an employer was objecting to under Obamacare, objecting to the requirement that they provide contraceptive and abortion services to their employees, and he ruled it's a case in which the power of Congress was lodged against the religious rights, the religious freedom rights of the employer. And then in that case, and the Supreme Court eventually ruled the same way, said that a company that's personally holds, that is a family owns the company, sometimes referred to as closely held corporations, that they have a right under the First Amendment, freedom of religion provision, not to to make their own choices as to whether they can provide that kind of health care benefits. Without infringing their own religious freedom and their own religious beliefs. And so he ruled in favor of the persons who were the company, the employer, who was objecting to applying the Obamacare provision that required the company to provide health care in these areas that would infringe upon the religious rights of the employer. Now, the Supreme Court ended up ruling in a different, in a similar case, the way that Judge Gorsuch had ruled. So, in that sense, it's settled law, at least the court has said, what the relationship is between the Obamacare statute and the religious freedom rights of people under the First Amendment. So, but that's something that will undoubtedly come up and be discussed.
Is there anything you see that might disqualify him from becoming a United States Supreme Court justice? And what criteria will the Senate be looking at when they consider his nomination? Because we know that when he was confirmed to the appellate court where he is now, it was a unanimous vote.
Yes, and the Senate over the years has applied really two different sets of criteria. One set is addressing the qualities to which I just referred. That is, what kind of person is this? What are his skills? How good is a jurist is he? How good a lawyer is he maybe? What's his scholarly bent? Is he careful in his craft? Does he think through the legal issues with a high degree of care? Those kinds of personal characteristics relating to his ability to work with others. And that criteria really, with some exceptions, govern the early days of the appointment to the Supreme Court. Recently, the other set of criteria, which has been much more frequently raised, which is what's his personal viewpoints about things. Is he conservative? Is he liberal? Has he spoken publicly one way or the other on these critical issues that kind of seem to divide the Senate and divide the country? And focusing really on his ideology and trying to determine whether that's an ideology which is consistent with the ideology of the senator or the entire Senate. And so each member of the Senate has the choice of using one criteria or the other. Some senators will apply both. They said, well, he's a great person. He's a little too more conservative than me, but I think the more important part of Judge Gorsuch is his quality as a jurist. Others may say, no, I think the most important part of his credentials are what's his philosophy, what's his political point of view, because the court is evenly divided on critical issues, and some members of the Senate will want to look at that ideology very carefully.
What's been the impact of the Supreme Court being short of justice, if you will, for almost a year now? It will likely take, as I understand it, under normal circumstances, at least 2 months before there's a confirmation hearing and a vote for the Gorsuch nomination. What's the impact of this prolonged situation of having 8 as opposed to 9 justices?
Well, the problem always is when you have an even number, and this is not the first time the court has been in this situation, is that the court could divide evenly on cases. And if that happens, then the general practice of the court recently has simply to say we affirm the judgment below by an equally divided court. No opinion, one sentence, that's it. And that is an unfortunate situation because the court takes cases to decide them and give guidance not only to the people, but to lawyers and judges and members of the administration, Congress, et cetera. And so there's a thought that an evenly divided court is not a good thing. Now, how often has it happened in the last year? Not that often, really, maybe 3 or 4 times, where people were expecting an opinion on the merits. They expected the court to give guidance in this area of the law, but no guidance came because they split 4-4 with respect to a particular matter, and therefore the judgment below is simply affirmed. And that judgment below being affirmed has really no precedential value, so it really doesn't give any guidance to anybody when the court is split 4-4 like that. Now, of course, they've had some cases where they've been split 4-3, and that's insufficient because a quorum is 6. So it makes it more difficult. Just as Alito said, he didn't think it made that big a difference. You know, he said, it happens in life, and we go on with our work, and we do the best we can. Others have said, well, this 4-4 split is not good because it does prevent the court from deciding cases. But then again, sometimes people think that the court is split 5-4 or 4-4 all the time. It just isn't so. There are not a lot of 5-4 decisions, actually. And the court can, based on even the whether you're conservative, liberal, or somewhere in between, the court doesn't always split that way. You have cases in which some of the judges, conservative judges, join with the liberal judges or the other way around. And so it's sometimes overstated, the impact of the 5-4 decisions. We do have them, and some are very important cases, such as the Obamacare case was 5-4. But it just isn't the way the court normally works. But the 4-4 does put a crimp in the court's work, because if they are split 4-4, there's no precedential ruling, and therefore the court is not giving the guidance it should be giving to the country about a particular legal issue.
We hear a lot about diversity in society, but it's been pointed out that on the Supreme Court, you have justices who are all from the East Coast and were educated at either Harvard or Yale. They are either Roman Catholic or Jewish at this point. Gorsuch is, I believe, Episcopalian. He's from Colorado, but he was educated at Harvard Law School. So are we increasing diversity on the court by putting him on the bench?
Well,
are people making too much out of that, what I just talked about?
Well, two things about that. One is that President Trump has said that, you know, he's noted that. And he said, we're getting away from the Ivy League thing. And, of course, Gorsuch went to Columbia University as an undergraduate, which, of course, is Ivy League school. Then he went to Harvard Law School. So President Trump, although he had said he was going to move away from that, he really hasn't. Now, from a geographic point of view, yes, he was, although when he was a younger person, he lived in Washington, D.C. when his mother was an official in the Reagan administration, but he's basically Coloradan, and he's from that part of the country, and we really haven't, well, Justice O'Connor and Chief Justice Rehnquist were from Arizona. So the you're getting perhaps a little more geographic split. On the religious front, it's interesting that you say that, because from the beginning of the country, 1789, until Louis Brandeis, who was Jewish, was appointed during the Wilson administration, 1916, every justice was white, every justice was Protestant, with the one exception of Roger Taney, who Jackson appointed was Roman Catholic. So there were no Roman Catholics, no Jews, no Muslims, no anyone in the court except Protestants and white males until really Justice Brandeis in 1916. So recently on the court, and that's one of the major shifts, whether it has anything to do with their jurisprudence, anything to do with decisions, I can't say, because I don't, you know, you have to be in the mind of the justice to know that. But it's true, there are now six, I think, Roman Catholics and three Jewish Jews on the court. He will be the minority, really, as a he says Episcopalian, is that what it is?
That's how I understand he is, yes.
Yeah. As somebody once said, it's six wives away from being Roman Catholic, you know, because Henry VIII, you know, broke from the church over his wives. He'll be a minority, but he will reflect what the court was for all those years. And so he's more typical, at least historically, in terms of religion. Whether it has anything to do with the course, we don't. I've never thought that it did, but you know, maybe some people do.
There were conservatives who had reservations about Donald Trump, but they voted for him because mm-hmm. they believed that he would put a justice on the Supreme Court who would perhaps one day repeal Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. What do you think the likelihood of that is?
I don't think it's very likely. I'll tell you why. Because, first of all, conservative justices say that they're very tied to precedents. That's one of the aspects of conservatism, is to, we're not going to radically change things. We're going to stick to what the traditions were. And Roe v. Wade now has been here, what, 43 years or so? And there are justices who would say, and Neil Gorsuch may be one of them, who say, well, if this abortion case were coming to me for the first time, I might very well rule in favor of the right to life. He said, but we've had this precedent for all these years, since 1973. I'm not inclined to disturb it because I believe in stability in the law. I believe we shouldn't be changing the important constitutional principles just because we happen to have a different view about it. And the stability of the law is more important than other issues related to it. And so he might very well say that. And in addition, there are now five justices on the court, on the current court, who support Roe versus Wade. Adding, even if he publicly says he's against, he's going to overrule it, that will not make a difference on the court because there are now five justices who are firmly in the camp of Roe versus Wade, including Justice Kennedy, who's considered the swing justice. They had an opinion last June where the five emerged very clearly. So that's not likely to happen. If President Trump gets a second appointment, perhaps it will, if one of the five were to leave the court and now we put someone who wishes to overrule Roe. The other thing about overruling Roe is that it does put the power back in the hands of the states to address the abortion issue. At the time of Roe in 1973, there was a clear trend in state legislatures to change the law to permit abortion in some circumstances. And what you'd have is probably half the country, maybe more than half, would authorize, the other half wouldn't. And that may have its own problems. The uniformity of Roe is that the same rules apply to every state in the union. So you don't get an immediate ability to imprison people, for example, or try them for murder if they commit an abortion. You have to have the legislature intervene. And I often wondered whether while you hear this talk among people who believe in the right to life, that it's murder, first-degree murder, really, because it's premeditated. you wonder really whether they would follow that through if they had the opportunity and convict doctors and mothers or prospective mothers or people who have abortions of first-degree murder and send them to electric chair. Are they going to do that? I don't think so. So, but, you know, that question's never come up, and we reporters don't seem to want to ask that question of presidents or anything. But that's, yeah, when you follow that down the line, when you say, well, if you overrule Roe, what happens, that's what could happen.
Well, I think that question did get asked of President Trump, or as candidate Trump, when he was asked about whether he thought there should be penalties against women who have abortions. And initially he said yes, but then he later backtracked on that. But
oh, yes. I'm glad you reminded me that. I had forgotten that. Yeah, he did backtrack. But you don't know. I mean, he's not the one who sits in state legislatures. You know, he doesn't control that. And so some legislators are quite intent on overturning Roe and imposing penalties. We don't know what type because we haven't seen it for a while.
Do you think we're in for a real Donnybrook in Washington in the Senate over this confirmation for Justice Gorsuch?
I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because he's so well qualified on the one set of criteria that I said before. He's really well liked by people. He's a brilliant scholar. He's been a very fine judge. He has some rulings that conservatives are not going to like when he sat on in his role as a judge on the Court of Appeals. So I don't think so. And I think the reason is because in some of the critical cases, such as the Roe against Wade and the affirmative action cases, there are five judges who agree with that. And so his ability to change these kinds of controversial precedents is diminished because of it. And plus, we haven't heard him speak about what he views as precedents and whether they should be lightly overturned. And so they could be getting someone here who actually maybe agrees with them, say the conservatives, but he's not going to overrule a prior precedent because he believes in the stability of the law. So I think that's critical. Now, and the other thing, factor too, is that if President Trump has a second choice, that may be the really critical person that could change the composition of the court in critical cases. And so perhaps the Democrats might say, well, maybe we should save up our fire for the second nomination because we want to be able to have the filibuster rule stay in place for this nomination because they won't use the so-called nuclear option. And so they need 60 votes for it, and some Democrats will vote with the Republicans to confirm Judge Gorsuch. But they want to set the precedent with this Senate that 60 votes in the filibuster should remain for Supreme Court justices. So when the next one comes around, they'll have the ability to filibuster it if they need to.